and welcome to Fade Out, the podcast that examines the final films of Hollywood's brightest lights. Proud member of the Findwater Podcast Network, I'm your host, Rob Kelly. For this episode, our subject is actor Frederick March, winner of two Best Actor Oscars. March was born Ernest Frederick Bickle in 1897. In his 20s, he rejected a prosperous future in banking to pursue his love of acting. March began his career as a movie extra and then on Broadway, where his versatility led him to being signed by Paramount. Within a year, he would appear in seven films. In short order, March became one of the most dependable leading men in Hollywood, headlining dramas, period pictures, and comedies. In 1931, he starred in Ruben Mamoulian's adaptation of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, which in many ways remains the definitive take on the classic horror story. Aided by superb makeup and inventive camera work, March would win his first Best Actor Oscar. He co-starred with Gary Cooper and Miriam Hopkins in the 1933 Ernst Lubitsch classic Design for Living, and with Carol Lombard in the 1937 screwball comedy Nothing Sacred. That same year, he played the tragic Norman Maine in A Star is Born, for which he was nominated for a third time for Best Actor. He would continue to work on stage in between film projects, often alongside his wife, actor Florence Eldridge. In 1946, he won his second Best Actor Oscar, playing a returning World War II veteran in William Wyler's masterpiece, The Best Years of Our Lives, opposite Myrna Loy. Now an elder statesman, but having lost none of his power, March continued turning in excellent performances in films such as 1951's Death of a Salesman, 1954's Executive Suite, 1955's The Desperate Hours, and 1956's The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit. He played opposite rising star Kim Novak in 1959's Middle of the Night, based on the Paddy Chayefsky play about a man who falls in love with a woman half his age. That same year, he squared off against Spencer Tracy in Stanley Kramer's adaptation of Inherit the Wind, playing creationist Matthew Harrison Brady, a fictionalized William Jennings Bryan. March's gravity and personal dignity led him to narrating numerous documentaries and specials focusing on American history, at one point being asked to recite the Gettysburg Address in front of the U.S. Congress. He played fictional President Jordan Lyman in 1964's 7 Days in May, staring down a military coup led by Burt Lancaster. March would frequently claim he was retired, but kept getting lured back for one film or another, like the 1967 Western Hombre or the 1970 racial drama Tick, Tick, Tick. Now in ill health, in what would be his final film, March summoned the energy to reteam with his 7 Days in May director John Frankenheimer to play Harry Hope, the saloon owner, in a four-hour adaptation of Eugene O'Neill's The Iceman Cometh. Here with me to discuss The Iceman Cometh and the career of Frederick March is writer, researcher, and self-appointed Frederick Marchologist, Jill Blake. Hi, Jill. Welcome back.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me. I mean, that introduction was fantastic. I don't know why you need me.
Oh,
that
come was... on. What are you talking about?
No, that was fantastic.
Thank you. I mean, look, as we talked about off air, each of us talking about Frederick March is like right over the plate. You know, just I got to read it was an excuse to read a biography about him where I just drank it in and I watched a whole bunch of his movies that I hadn't seen. And I know you are the biggest Frederick March fan that I know of. I didn't know of any other Frederick March fans until I became aware of you. And so, you know, and I defer to your superior wisdom on this topic. And that's why I wanted to have you on. You were on a couple of years ago. We talked about William Wyler's. We worked about his career, but also The Best Years of Our Lives, which Frederick March was in. But I always wanted to have you on to talk about Frederick March because, and this is going to lead into the first thing I want to ask you is, when I was working at a video store, Movies Unlimited, and right after mm-hmm. I got out of college, and I was sending, you know, I basically say that was me going to film school because the store had everything, and I just watched everything I could get my hands on. I made no discernment between, you know, Jean Renoir films and Grindhouse, you know, Herschel Gordon Lewis. Mm-hmm. I took it all in, but I had never really heard of Frederick March before then. But this guy, as soon as I saw two or three of his movies, I locked in on this guy. And that's never gone away. And I don't, to this point, I still don't exactly know why, but I know I do. So can you help me? What is it about Frederick March?
It's funny that you say that because my friend Millie DiCirico, who worked for TCM and she created TCM Underground, she is also a huge Frederick March fan, and she has a Substack that she, I think she launched it last year, and she just kind of does, musings and articles and things. And she texted me one night and she asked me, hey, I want to get into like interviewing people. Would you be like the first person I interview? And I want to talk to you about Frederick March. And the whole thing about this, interview was, what is it about him that like checks all the boxes? Like, and it's so, and it's like he's so unassuming. You would never think of him as a leading, like a romantic lead or a, like spot on Mark Twain impersonator or whatever. But like, he could really do it all. And he has kind of this, well, there's a longevity to his career that actors only dream of, right? And that he was able to transition from kind of this matinee idol to more character roles. But there's something about watching him today, even in some of the more dated pieces that he did, that like everything translates. It translates to modern sensibilities, to modern sensibilities on how acting is today. There's something so modern about him. And I think where it comes down to is that he wasn't hung up on any kind of stardom. He didn't really cling to celebrity like so many other actors of the time, and that there were a lot of actors, and no shade against them. I should say they were stars. They were stars first and actors second or third or fourth. But he was an actor number one. And so I think that's what really makes him stand out, and why he's just so good is that he had no interest in the stardom aspect of it. He certainly reaped the benefit of it, and he knew that. But he also knew that that was not a, there's a quote, and I'm gonna do a really bad job of paraphrasing it, but he basically says that stardom is very tricky. It's a steep slope. And at a certain point, you're up at the top on a sled, and you don't know how long you're going to be up there, but eventually you're going to slide down. And so he knew that it was kind of this fleeting thing. So what better to do than to invest it into honing your craft and being flexible in the type of roles that you take. So I think that's really what I think. And there's a lot of times I'll talk to people who are, and I'm rambling and I'm sorry, but where somebody, like you were just saying, Rob, you watch a movie and you watch a couple movies and you go, holy shit, where's this guy been? This is crazy. You're not the first person that said that to me, where they're like, wait a minute. Like, I thought, okay, yeah, he made Jekyll and Hyde, and yeah, he's in Best Years, and he's great in both of those. But oh my God, I watched Middle of the Night. Can you believe this guy? He's incredible. And I'm like, yeah, I know. So I did not always love him. And I had seen him, you mentioned Executive Suite in your opening.
I love that movie.
It's fantastic, right? But he plays such a like slimy guy. And there's nothing slimier than the company controller, right? And I'm going, God, this guy is really giving me the heebie-jeebies. And I had discovered that movie because I was on like a William Holden kick, and I was just like watching everything on William Holden's filmography. I was like, who the hell is this guy? And then a couple years later, there was a like the Star of the Month. No, I'm sorry. It was A Summer Under the Stars. So they on TCM. So they dedicate 24 hours to one actor. And Frederick March was on there. And I was like, oh my God, this guy's so awesome. And then it took me, because I was watching him as much younger in all these films. And I'm going, God, man, where has this guy been all my life? And then I realized, holy shit, this is the same guy on the Senate executive suite, right? And I was like, so this guy has to be really, really good at what he does to make me despise him in this role. And that's kind of what sold me on it. And so I kind of forgot where you wanted me to go with this. I just started rambling.
I didn't have any intention of where I wanted to go. I just wanted to I want you to help me figure it out because I've been pondering. I obviously have been thinking about this for decades and very specifically since we decided to do the show. But like when I like I, again and back in the movie the video store that I worked at, we had a section called Hollywood's Best where films were grouped by star. So it was like all the Humphrey Bogart movies, all the Marlon Brando movies, all the Bette Davis movies, all the Clint Eastwood movies, yada, yada, yada. They were never going to have a Frederick Marx section because no one,
No.
as you put in your in that interview, quote, this is a quote from your interview, no one normal knows who Frederick Marx is. So I was like, okay, raise his hand. But like,
Yeah.
I mean, like literally, was he a movie star? Yes, because he top
Yeah.
lined many movies. He was the number one guy on the call sheet, as they say, for a great many movies. So he
Yeah.
was by definition a movie star. But I think about the people that he came up with, Humphrey Bogart, Bette Davis, Gary Cooper, all, and this is not at all a knock on any of those performers, obviously, but like even in as diverse roles as those actors might have had, their essential Humphrey Bogartness comes through. And even if he's playing, Fred C.
Right.
Dobbs or he's playing Rick Blaine, the Humphrey Bogarty thing, which is, I guess, what you would they call star quality, bleeds
Yeah.
through. And that's that. And you just, I don't say you know what you're getting. It's not that. It's just he's Bogart is Bogart across all these movies, even if he's
Right.
playing very, very, very
Yes.
different roles. Frederick Marx isn't doing that. Frederick
No.
Marx, and you mentioned this about the length of his career, is that like one of the films I watched that I had not seen in preparation for this was Death Takes a Holiday. Where
Yeah.
he plays literally the death itself who gives himself a
Yeah.
holiday so he can understand why humanity fears him and hates him, and he gets involved with these society people. And that film's from like 1931, right? And so he's got the leading man eye makeup that they all wore back then, and
Yeah.
the foundation where his skin is chalk white, and it's a very 1931 kind of performance. Not again, not a knock, but it's that
Right.
style. You flash
Yeah.
forward to Hombre, and he's up against
Yeah.
Paul Newman, and you're like, this is a guy who has had to modulate everything he knows about acting, and
Yes.
he's done it. He's managing to do it where he's
Yeah.
just as interesting in as a guy opposite Paul Newman in Hombre as he is playing Death in
Yeah.
Death by a Holiday. It's like it's amazing what a chameleon this guy was.
Yeah, that's a good point you bring up about, because, someone like Bogey that you mentioned, like, I love him. And, there's a good, I'd say, five performances that I think are just a master class in acting, but you would never see Bogey treading the boards. So he was a good actor in what was given to him, and I mean, if you watch like early Bogart films at MGM in the 30s, they didn't know what to do with him. And so, and he was stiff and stilted, I think about him. I think he's like the stable boy in Dark Victory. Like, it just doesn't make any
Sure,
sense.
Humphrey
They
Bogart is the stable boy.
just didn't, they really did not know what to do with him. And then But there is this boginess, like you said, that like comes through the performances. Like, I think with the exception of probably Treasure of the Sierra Madre, every performance you go, that's bogey. Like, I know bogey, right? And Cary Grant, who I absolutely love almost as much as Frederick March. But that man could not play, a period piece to save his life. He tried it twice, and both were horrendous failures. He's not meant to be in you know, in like Revolutionary War style clothing. And aside from, again, I mean, he was magnificent in everything. I think he gives the performance of a lifetime in Notorious and None But the Lonely Heart and Penny Serenade. But in a lot of the performances, you go, yeah, that's Cary Grant up there. Only Angels Have Wings. That's another one that's kind of like he is just kind of buried in the role. But with Frederick March, he, you know, outside of, because again, they didn't know what to do with him. And I've talked about this before, and not a lot of people realize this, but when he signed with Paramount, again, they had no clue what to do with him. They were casting him opposite Clara Bow as like, you know, boy toy. You know, he's in like True to the Navy wearing a little sailor outfit, you know, and he's adorable, but they just don't know what to do with him. And so it was really Ruben Mamoulian. Well, let me back up. He did Royal Family of Broadway, which that kind of turned the tide for him
Right, you're playing
because
a sort of
he
John Barrymore sort of.
exactly. And he played the role on stage there in LA, and John Barrymore came and saw it, and he loved it, right? And March was kind of known in Hollywood at that time. This would have been like 1929 or so. He was known as the John Barrymore impersonator. And I actually have a photo still from I think it was like a radio production, and Frederick March is in full like John Barrymore getup. It is a very rare still that I was able to procure. And so he does this on stage, and it's a huge hit, and you know, Paramount gets the rights and they adapt it for the screen. He gets his first Academy Award nod, and so it's kind of like, okay, this guy is pretty serious. But Paramount's like, look, you know, we're gonna still put you in these like whatever B romances, and kind of, you know, again, they don't know what to do with them. And this is kind of a period too where women were, they were the bigger stars
Right,
for, you
yeah.
know, the roles were juicier for women. Which is, I think, is fantastic. But it was Ruben Mamoulian that really changed things for him because he fought to get March cast. Paramount did not think he could pull it off. They were like, what are you doing? This guy's like a, you know, matinee idol type. He is not a serious actor. And Mamoulian's like, I don't know about that. And so he fought to get him cast. And you know, March was like, all right, I'll show you that I can do this. So I think that really is what, you know, kind of changed things for him. And again, he started his acting training on the stage. And then he went to Elitch Gardens, which was like a summer stock theater in Denver, Colorado. And that's where he met Lawrence Eldridge. And, you know, the theater was first, always. So he was, you know, any chance he got, he was going back to the stage. And, you know, the starring in film is what paid the bills and allowed him to go and be in whatever theatrical production. So yeah, I just think he had this ability to transform, and it's not quite character acting. I mean, it wasn't like he was gaining a bunch of weight or going on the Christian Bale starvation diet,
Right.
or
Yeah.
you know, really method acting wasn't really a thing. I would say I would argue that John Garfield is probably the on the early kind of a proto method acting, and then you get into Montgomery Clift and Brando and you know, James Dean and all that. But he definitely lost himself somewhat in those roles. And they were convincing. And so I think you never knew what you were going to get with him, which makes him fascinating and one of the greatest to ever do it.
It's amazing to think, as I mentioned in the intro, like the Rooman Mamoulian, Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, I really think it still is the version of that story.
Oh, absolutely.
Right? Because you're like, well, what are the other famous Dr. Jekyll movies? Well, there was the Spencer Tracy one, which most people argue is not as good as the one with Marge.
No,
And then you're like,
save for Ingrid Bergman, who is very good in it. And what's funny is Spencer Tracy, so March and Tracy were, okay friends. And when Tracy starred in that, and see, MGM got the rights to Jekyll and Hyde, and they suppressed
right, the earlier one, right.
the earlier version. And Spencer Tracy, and again, I'm going to badly paraphrase this, but he basically told March, like, I did you the biggest favor ever by starring in this because I was so bad in it that, everybody will remember your performance, but Spencer Tracy's take on it was, I mean, it's not great, but his take is interesting. It's not awful. But the March version is a marvel of acting and camera tricks and makeup. So you have Wally Westmore's makeup, you have the use of filters. I mean, shit, Frederick March almost was permanently disfigured because of this makeup, So, and it's absolutely incredible. And still watching it today, it's pretty believable. It's really believable, special effects. So, or practical effects, I should say. Yeah, it's just, and I still show it to people now, and they're like, what the hell? People in 1931 were probably freaking out. And I'm like, yeah, they had to have been.
Yeah, I mean, you think about it, it's a 90-year-old movie. First of all, he wins a Best Actor Oscar for a horror part, which you can count
That's
on one
right.
hand the amount of actors that have been able to
Oh,
do
yeah, I
that,
think it
right?
would be after him is Anthony Hopkins, if I'm not mistaken.
So you're talking 50 years later, like that's it, basically. But yeah, it's still like it's still the version of it, which is just amazing to think that there have been 100 Frankensteins and 100 Draculas and 100 Wolfmans, and yet there's really not been another Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, which is it's in public domain, I assume at this point. It's not any, so you would think with that's IP, with Hollywood is like obsessed with every piece of
Oh, I
IP
know.
that's just laying around. Like, make
I
Dr.
know.
Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. I don't understand.
I'm honestly surprised that there hasn't been, and hopefully this does, some producers like, I got an idea. I'm honestly surprised it has not been reimagined once again. And I know that there's been lots of versions, not anything, huge or anything, but I'm really surprised that, someone like Ari Aster or like, that, yeah, that basically Neon or A24 hasn't done some, version of it.
Yeah.
Well, watch it. They'll probably announce it next week.
There we go. I'm just ahead of the curve here. But so yeah, he does all of these. I mean, a lot of light stuff, a lot of, but I mean, some of it's terrific. I mean, Nothing Sacred is just one of the great
Oh, it's
all-time
weird. So
screwball. I mean,
weird.
when you watch it, I had not seen it until about a year ago, and I was shocked at like how much he slaps around Carol Weathers. I
Oh,
mean, she
yeah.
hits him right back, but still, you're like, whoa, wow, that
Yeah.
he kicks her right in the butt there.
And that's, I think, I'm not, I can't count it off. Let's see, I'm trying to think. Let's see, one, two, three, four. I think he made five color films, maybe six. And the two in 1937, that's two of them. So Star is Born and Nothing Sacred. Just a very small handful of Technicolor films, which I always is just crazy to me considering how long he was doing it. That, come the 1950s. I think it's like Alexander the Great, Columbus was another one. Iceman Cometh.
Man in the Great
Okay,
Flannel
maybe
Suit.
seven.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe
Not a
seven.
lot, though. Not a
Yeah,
lot. Yeah.
not a lot. I was going with like three. Whatever. Don't pay attention to me. But no, that's Nothing Sacred is just a bizarro movie. And speaking of, Millie DeCicco, she loves that movie so much. She's like, it is the most bonkers. I love him. I love that she's like, I love that Billy Barty comes running out and like bites him on the leg. Like, it's just a bizarre film.
It's just funny to
And
think that he's
hilarious.
doing, yeah, it is. I mean,
Yeah.
it's so funny to see him doing all this kind of light stuff, and yet
Yeah.
I think of him, because I came to him as a much older man, as
Right.
this figure. And it's so funny, because like one of the things that I really keyed into him as an older actor, and there are some variations, because Inherit the Wind is one of my all-time favorite films, and he's not
Yeah.
this way in Inherit the Wind. But in a lot of his roles in his later years, he is this sort of paragon of virtue. Like
Yeah.
he is made of such stern stuff. He's a strong figure, and that like I really got it. Like when he shows up in a movie, like, okay, nobody, he's an older guy, but nobody's gonna push him around, right?
No,
You know,
no.
like he is gonna stand rock solid. And even in a movie like The Desperate Hours with the aforementioned Humphrey Bogart, where he's just a regular family man, and Bogart's, the criminal that Bogart plays breaks into his house and holds his family hostage. It's, you're thinking, well, all right, Friedrich March is an older man, and yet he still is kind of like, he's letting Bogey know, I'm only going to put up with so much of this,
That's right.
you know?
Oh yeah,
And
he did that great. I mean, and he wasn't like super tall or like had an imposing build stature, but he always commanded the space. So if like take Frankenheimer 7 Days in May. Oh man, when he's
oh.
having that showdown, that 10-minute showdown
Oh my God,
with
that
Burt
scene.
Lancaster. I mean, that is I mean, there's a whole story behind that, and but it's like Burt Lancaster is this like masculine acrobat looking bodybuilder. I'm gonna beat you just with my words, like very imposing, manly man. And then you have Frederick March, right? And Frederick March is like, I am not threatened at all by you. Like it is the way that they filmed that scene and the way that March held his own. And and actually what was happening is Burt Lancaster had been really sick and he missed rehearsals, and Frederick March, who did not have to do this because he's at the time of his career where he can make whatever demands or whatever, and he comes in on Saturdays and works with Lancaster one-on-one to get this scene right. So the way that he holds that space against this imposing Lancaster is incredible. He did that every single time he performed. And even, in his much later performances where he was physically frail, visibly frail, I should say, he still had this presence that he was very much in control of the situation. And I think that really comes down to the fact that he was an actor of the stage, and knowing what it takes to hold an audience's attention and to project and to command the stage. It's just a different type of training. And all of and it a lot of you don't see very often stage actors that make the transition to film and back, right? A lot of times it just doesn't. I mean, this is a big reason why I think this is why Florence wasn't as big of a movie actor, is that she really was a stage actress. And he is one of a very small few who could seamlessly go back and forth.
But yeah, well, I mean, it's, before we move off of 7 Days in May, though,
Yeah,
there's one thing I really want to mention, because this jumped out at me in the book I mentioned earlier, Frederick March, A Consummate Actor by Charles
Oh,
Strandberg,
yeah.
where it's talking about this movie and it says, The film provided March with one of his best scenes, one of his best scene performances as the supposedly milquetoast president who outmaneuvers the coup and saves the Constitution.
Yeah.
That jumped out of me in the year of our Lord 2024. It really did. That scene, I remembered watching that movie again. I brought it home from the video store. And when you get to that scene where he just, through the force of his person, the moral clarity he brings to that character, Jordan Lyman, and he absolutely goes toe-to-toe with, as you say, the very imposing Burt Lancaster, who was very physical, as we know. He was like 6'4". I mean, and he speaks as General Scott. He speaks in this very precise language, like he's very clipped kind of talking like this. And it's a little frightening. And you're like, well, this guy really believes his own bullshit. And he sits down with this supposedly weak president. And man, March just crushes it. And you're like, I was literally like pumping my fist. I was so excited. Like, why can't we have presidents like this?
For real. And he, so that scene, that 10 minutes, so there was lots of rehearsals. And so like for those 3 weeks, so it was, they were already working 5 days a week. Lancaster had like a bout of hepatitis or something. And then for Saturday and Sunday for 3 weeks, Lancaster and March worked together. And then the actual filming of that scene took about 2 days, which is incredible that it only took 2 days. And Frank and Emmer later was like, look, that's nuts. We should have spent twice as long filming it. But that, well, the script, but that specifically, the so it was based on Fletcher. I've always said Fletcher Knebel, but I don't know if it's Knebel. But, you know, it was based on the book, but the dialogue, and specifically the dialogue for that scene was written by Rod Serling.
Oh man.
And so this is like, so think about this. You've got Frankenheimer behind the camera, you've got Rod Serling writing the words, and you've got Lancaster and March in this just, I mean, that is really, that scene is the one where you're like gripping the table.
Yeah.
You're gripping the sides of your chair because it is, everything comes down to this. And when March goes and opens up the drawer and he has the letters and he's about to pull them out and use them. And he knows that once he does that, there's no going back, you know?
Yep.
So, that is just a masterclass performance. I did a whole, back in the Filmstruck days when Filmstruck was still its brief 2 year life on this planet. I did a, they occasionally do these like special features for, to go along with the movies on the service. And so I did a, what they called a scene on Filmstruck, and it was like a scene analysis. So I could pick, you know, I was given like, hey, pick anything out of this movie. And I was like, well, I got to pick this 10 minute showdown, you know, wrote up my script for it, recorded it. It's just, he was incredible in that role and great in everything. He did have a tendency, and he knew this, he had a tendency to get a little hammy.
Yeah. He would ask the director, am I getting a little over the top?
That's right. I mean, like Inherit the Wind is a perfect example. I love that movie and it's a great performance. But there are some moments where like Kramer should have reeled his ass in a little bit. but, you know, with the right direction and understanding, you know, kind of how grandiose he could get, he was masterful. And, you know, I think Frankenheimer understood that. Wyler understood that. Mamoulian understood that. You know, so he was great.
Yeah. I mean, fun fact for everybody. Yeah. Frederick March was introduced in 7 Days in May. The first time you see him, he is getting his blood pressure taken by a doctor who is telling him, you're working too hard. You're going to give yourself a heart attack. You've got to relax. He is introduced the exact same way in The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit.
That's right.
He's the head of this company, and the first time we see him, he's getting his blood pressure taken and being told, you're working too hard, you're going to have a heart attack. And so there's something so wonderful about a guy that seems so morally like a bedrock, and yet there's, you know, they're layering in. He's fragile, though. He's an older man, and he's fragile, but he'll have the goods when he needs them. Now, there's so many, oh my God, we could just go on and on. There's so much I want to ask you.
Yeah.
But before, because we're going to talk about Frankenheimer, because obviously he works with Frankenheimer again for his last film, and there's so much to say about There's Man Cometh. But before I even ask you about like what your favorite little known Frederick March movie is, before we get to that, we do need to talk about Best Years of Our Lives.
Oh, of course.
Because
we do.
It's one of the greatest films ever made. It is criminally not known, I'd say, by I would say the average person, maybe I'm running in different circles, but I would say the average person knows what Casablanca is. They probably haven't seen it, but they know what it is. Same thing with, say, Citizen Kane, right? Or maybe even if you want a High Noon or Wizard of Oz, maybe they haven't seen these movies because so many people are like, you know, Star Wars is an old movie at this point. So going back and further, but Best Years of Our Lives is unfortunately not known outside of film nerds, which is tragic because every time I watch it, I go, this is one of the greatest movies ever made.
Oh yeah.
You know?
Well, and for years, I mean, to be honest, Rob, like for years, even amongst, you know, weirdos like us, they didn't know the movie. And it's because it was out of print, or it hadn't been, I think there was like, I don't think for years TCM couldn't air it. So it wasn't getting any play. And then there wasn't, I think there was like an old DVD that was out for like a hot minute, but you could not find a good copy of it, for whatever, you know, licensing issues and stuff. And I don't think, see, now they play it quite often on TCM, but there were years and years and years where it was not on there. And so I think that has something to do with it.
Okay. Now that's baffling why that would be. I mean, it won Best Picture for Pete's
sake. It's crazy. You know? But I mean, I think it's in the last, I would say, decade-ish, it has finally gotten, you know, new eyes on it. And, you know, I think it's always been amongst, you know, film lovers as this, you know, as one of the greatest movies ever made, like no question. But it's not been since like the last, I think it was 2014 that they had the world premiere restoration. And I was at that.
Wow.
And that was at the TCM Fest, and beautiful restoration. And then a Blu-ray came out shortly after that. And I think that's really when, and they started playing it on TCM. And so I don't know what the deal was in terms of like rights or whatever. But now when you're talking about normal people, nobody knows this movie.
Yeah.
And, you know, they all know Wizard of Oz, and they know Gone with the Wind, and they know Casablanca and Singing in the Rain and Butch Cassidy and, you know, Bond movies or whatever.
Lawrence of Arabia. You know. I mean, it's kind of the same 10, 20
movies. Dr. Zhivago. Yeah, exactly. It's the same ones that, you know, get pushed out whenever there's like a, you know, Oscar montage of like great cinematic moments. You know, if I had a nickel for every time I, you know, see Vivian Leigh, you know, the silhouette of Vivian Leigh like saying she won't go hungry again, you know, as like the great cinematic moment, I'm like, ugh. But no, Best Years of Our Lives is it's a miracle of a film, and there's such a fascinating story behind it, and how William Wyler came to direct it, and you know what all had gone on, and you know, it was a very realistic portrayal of that. It is not easy to come back. You have these guys that were not soldiers. And I don't think people understand this, that like now, people voluntarily enter into the military,
Right,
right? We
right.
don't, we have not, luckily, fortunately, had a draft. But so people forget that you had guys, like Frederick March's character, who was a banker, who had probably never held a gun in his life. Okay. And then you have Dana Andrews's character, who, is a soda jerk again, probably. I mean, these are people that were that lived in a in the bustling metropolis of Boone City, and fictional Boone City. And and then you have the star quarterback of the high school football team. These are people who were told, you have to go do this, you have to leave your families, you have to train, and you have to kill people. And then they're gone. There is no FaceTime. There are no phone calls. You may get a letter that is, you get a month after it was written and sent, if that. These guys were gone for years. And then they come back, and everyone around them has gone back to their, like nothing ever happened. And so the way that it portray, it was very groundbreaking for the time to say, you know what, it is not easy, and it's not, this kind of like, woo, okay, I'm back, everything's great, my family, woo, I love it. No, you see a man who his children grew up without him being there, and he's expected to go back to this life where everyone around him is so indifferent about everything, and he's frustrated that they don't understand, like the things he saw. And one of his fellow veterans comes in looking for a loan, and he has to deny him because he doesn't, so
Yeah, he's
it's
no collateral, right? And yeah.
exactly. So it really was, very daring and groundbreaking. And the fact that of all places, Samuel Goldwyn pushes this out there, because it was not, I mean, it ends on a happy note, but it is not a happy film. These guys are dealing with serious demons. And March's character is a drunk. And sometimes it's played for laughs. And when I've seen that, in a theater with people, they laugh at his drunkenness, and it's not funny at all. And Dana Andrews is having, PTSD flashbacks, and Harold Russell's character lost both of his hands. And so it's, and the fact that they actually had a real veteran playing, not an actor playing that role, is just incredible. It really is a masterpiece of a film that I think resonates today, even though it is, what, 70, 80 years old now,
Yeah.
almost 80 years old.
Yep.
And I wish that more people would see it, because it
For
truly, I've never had someone go, well, that movie sucked.
you're not gonna hang out with someone that would say that, Jill. I don't think
No,
they're gonna be
absolutely
in your
not.
circle.
But almost everyone that I've pointed to, to watch it, they're like, oh my God, where has this movie been all my life? It's truly, yeah, the only bad part of the movie, the only weak link, is the dumb son. And they get him out of there in the first act. I mean, he
Yeah,
has
he
gone, and
disappears. Yeah,
he
that
never comes home again. I mean,
doesn't.
that's really the only negative of the whole thing. As I've he must have been somebody's, like a nepo baby, and they were like, you got to give him a role, and he's like, wah, wah, wah. And then he goes to school never to return. And that was probably, William Wyler's like, look, this dude sucks, we got to get him out of here.
For a 3-hour movie, maybe that's part of the reason it has not You know, it's just a tougher
Yeah.
watch for a lot of people.
Yeah.
But for a 3-hour movie, it leaves so much unsaid. It treats its
Yeah.
characters and
Yeah.
its audience with such respect that it's like
Yeah.
things, it's a little look. I mean, March is top billed. March and Myrna Loy are top billed because they
Yeah.
were by far the most famous people. But they are
Right.
not the stars of the movie. It's
No.
really Dana Andrews is and Teresa Wright are really kind of
Right.
the, I'd say, the stars of it. But
I would
March
agree with
does
that.
so much with so little. That scene that you
Yeah.
mentioned where the fellow veteran comes in and needs a
Yeah.
loan, and March is sort of saying, "Well, do you have any collateral?" And the guy's like, "Well, no, I don't. I have my farm and I need the
Right.
loan to be
I
able to
have my
build, and that will
hands.
give me, yeah, I have my
Yeah.
hands." And you can see the look come across March's face of like, no, this is what I got to do for this guy. This is why I'm here,
Well,
is to
he's
do
warring
this.
with himself because he's
Yeah.
trying, you know, it, everybody wants him to get on with his life and to go back to the way things were. And he's, it's literally making, it's, he has a pit in his stomach, right? And you see him, he's trying really hard to put that hat on of the, you know, indifferent, cold banker that he was before. And when he chucks that out, because this guy's like, look, you know, I have my collateral is in my hands. It is in my work. I'm good for it. I work hard. You know, I need this. And that's when the switch flips. And then later on, when he is being honored, and this also speaks to how, not to go too far down this path, but you know, we do see people who, you know, praise the military and thank you for your service and thank you for their service. And then when they come back, they don't care about them. That there's no help for them. There's no services. There it is, it's all smoke and mirrors, right? And but they love to prop someone up who's done it and go, oh, look at us, we support this person, blah, blah, blah. And that's what happens with Ray Collins's character, is he, you know, wants to like, oh, I know a veteran. Look at this. You know, and now he's our top guy. He's going to be working with veterans because he has the bank's best interests at heart. So basically, they're going to prey on veterans, right, to get their business, and but he's to lure them in, right, and then ultimately they're going to do the bait and switch and the bank's best interest and for the investors that, you know, Al's going to do the right thing. And at that dinner where he's like, screw it, I'm gonna speak my mind. And you know, you see the look on, you know, Ray Collins's face where he realizes that is where that scene is what won him the Oscar, I'll tell you that. It's just masterful, and it was really, really gutsy for Wyler to put that in the movie.
It's just an absolutely amazing movie, top to bottom. Every time I watch it, I'm just blown away by how
Oh,
adult
yeah.
it is, how sharp it is, how
That's right.
smart it is, how empathetic it is. I mean, the scene
Yeah.
with, again, I mean, we could really clearly fill a whole show just talking about best years of our lives. But I mean, the scene of Harold Russell revealing how
Oh, God.
helpless he is when he takes
I
his
know.
hooks off, and that he and
Yeah.
the you know he's got his fiance, and it's an incredibly sexual scene for a 1946
Yeah.
movie. It's got real
Yeah.
kind of sit, I don't say sizzle. That's too, I don't
Well,
know.
it's
That's not
just
serious enough.
intimate.
It's
It's
intimate. It's got a real intimacy
very,
that you don't expect in a
yeah.
1946 movie, I'm guessing, is
No.
what I would say.
No, it's like his vulnerability, and it's very like he's saying, this is what your life is going to be like if you marry me. And I'm going to show you this, and it's going to scare you off. And the fact that she stands there and she's like, let me help you do this, like, and showing him nothing that, like, I can face anything, like, nothing is going to scare me away. And, you know, he's so vulnerable and she's so strong. And I swear to God, that scene wrecks me every single time. And when he lays down and he has the tear in his eyes, when he realizes that, because he doesn't want her to go away, he's doing that because he's trying to free her, right? Of being stuck with quote, I'm putting quotes around this, cripple, right? So, originally the character was supposed to, and again, I'm putting this in quotes because this is not proper, but was supposed to be a quote spastic. And then when Wyler saw that training video, the army training video that Harold Russell was doing, he has hooks. He's like, all right, we're
Yep, that's
changing
it.
things up. We're bringing this guy in. That was it. So, it just really is. So anybody that's listening to this that has not seen it, just do yourself a favor and watch the movie. It is incredible.
It really is. It just absolutely is. So,
I know what I'm watching when we get off this
yeah,
off
really.
this
I gotta
recording.
fire up the Blu-ray I've got. So, okay, well, we really do need to get to Iceman Cometh, but
Yes, we do.
one last thing I do want to ask you
Yeah.
is, what is your, do you have a favorite? I mean, saying obscure Friedrich Marx is kind of ridiculous because the whole
Yeah.
context is like most of his stuff is obscure at this
Yeah,
point.
yeah,
But for someone like, even for someone like you who's a mega fan, do you have one
yeah.
of his films that you're like, even people with a cursory knowledge of Friedrich Marx don't know this film, but I love it. Do you have one of those?
So it's going to be Middle of the Night.
Oh, mine's the same answer. It's the same thing.
I think it's Middle of the Night. Although more people recently have come to it, and this Australian label imprint, there was a Kim Novak box set years ago, and it's gone out of print, and it has Middle of the Night, Pal Joey. It's not a great set, okay, other than Middle of the Night. And so this label imprint has gotten the rights to it, and so they're putting it out on Blu-ray. And
Oh, that's
so
great.
right, so Middle of the Night will be on Blu-ray for the first time. I will definitely order it, but I am hoping that one of the labels stateside will get it. I was hoping long ago when Twilight Time was still in business that they, because they put out a lot of Columbia stuff. So I was hoping that maybe they would, or Kino. But yeah, Middle of the Night is probably it. It just, it's masterful. I think it's Kim Novak's best performance. She has often said that it was her favorite, her personal favorite. If I had to kind of give a, maybe like a runner up, I would say The Eagle and the Hawk. And that's 1934.
It's got your boy Cary Grant in it.
That's right. And think it's directed by, I want to say Mitchell Leeson, but that doesn't feel right. I don't have it in front of me, but Eagle and the Hawk, and actually it is on Blu-ray, and it was long unavailable. I had like a VHS copy that I would watch every now and then. But that one was released by Kino's Studio Classics line, and it's beautifully remastered, and that is a really, really great film. It's a very daring anti-war film, and it's about two pilots in the Royal Air Force during World War One. So that's always my, like, all right, you got to watch that one. But Middle of the Night is the first one that I always go for.
I had not seen Middle of the Night until about 3 weeks ago. And because
Oh,
it's really
wow.
hard to find. I mean, as you just talked about it, it's really hard to find. And then I saw that it was on Tubi, and I kind of always
Oh,
roll my
okay.
eyes a little because
Yeah.
Tubi shoves in 75 commercial, breaks,
At
and it's like,
really,
like you're
really
and like it's
bad,
like
badly timed.
I'm
It'll
like,
be like a
okay,
middle of
yeah,
a
middle of
word.
a line,
Yeah.
yeah, exactly. And I'm like, do I really want to spend 3 hours watching a 90-minute movie, which I'm gonna have to? But I was like, this sounds
Yeah.
interesting. Paddy Chayefsky, Friedrich Marx,
Right.
Kim Novak,
And Delbert Mann directing it.
Delbert
I mean,
Mann
it's like,
directing it. I mean, you know, I mean, good Lord. Martin Balsam, you know, who I love. And to me, it's like when Martin Balsam shows up in a movie, I'm like, ah, this is going to be good because Martin Balsam's in
Oh,
the
yeah.
supporting part. But so I put it on, and about 10 minutes in, it was funny because we, you know, I put it on, and in the, you know, first minute or two, I'm kind of like, oh, okay, all right. And I get up and I'm over at our kitchen. It's all one big room. So I'm in our kitchen and I'm like getting something ready for dinner. And then I'm like, I sat back and I'm like, this is really good. And then when I had to get up again, I paused it because I'm like, this is really good. I don't want to miss this. And every so often my wife would kind of come in from the other room and say, what are you watching? I would tell, and she goes, what's it about? And I'd say, well, you know, if you just give it the one sentence line, which is about an older man, Frederick March, who falls in love with a much younger woman, you kind of say, really? That's the whole movie. But you're like, but boy, it's just a really great character piece full of characters well observed. And Frederick March just is so fantastic in it. He's sad, but great. Like his, you know, his family, his sister and his daughter want him to be happy, but do they really? Because then he, you know, he says he's in love with this woman and they're not happy about it. I mean, I love the scene where he tells them all that he's going to get married to Kim Novak. And the only one that's happy for him is the son-in-law, Martin Balsam.
That's right. That's right.
Oh, that movie is so good. Oh my God.
when he comes back to, and this is a big spoiler alert, but they have a fight and they've pretty much called things off, and he comes back to his apartment and, you know, he looks out of the window and he's crying. It's raining or snowing or whatever. And his sister, who is just such a scold, and, you know, she comes and wraps the blanket around his legs. And that's for the first time you see him and you go, he's an old man.
Yeah.
Because when he's with her, he feels alive. And he talks about that. Like, he feels alive and that he, you know, is, but at the same time, you know, jealousy is consuming him. And I don't know if the foundations of this relationship are exactly healthy. There's definitely
I mean,
some
he is her
stuff
boss.
Going on.
There's
He
that
is her
too.
boss, and she is looking at him as a bit of a father figure. There's a lot to unpack there, but you have two people who are damaged, and sometimes it's not perfect, but sometimes those people have to be together. And this is one of those movies. It is a wonder of a film. Years ago, I found a beautiful Italian poster, and somehow I got it for like next to nothing. And it is just the most beautiful, beautiful poster. And it's hanging in my living room. And so I look at this every single day.
Oh,
And
that's great.
that is how much I love this film.
Oh, it's just
it's incredible.
Terrific. And just, I'd never even heard of it. I guess I'd seen it on his IMDb, but I was like, it's just not available anywhere. And so,
no, it's not. I mean, for years, I mean, it's just been like a copy of a copy of a copy that you know, find. And not that I'm advocating piracy, but if you're a classic Hollywood fan, sometimes you got to rely on people, and you get a little handshake there and you get the little cut. I mean, that's how most of these movies get seen. And, you know, so that was, you know, that's how I saw it, was like a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy. And so I'm happy that it's getting released. I would like it to have a Region A release. We'll see. We'll see.
Hopefully with a commentary track by Jill Blake, maybe. Who
Oh,
knows?
God.
What did they do? We're trying to manifest this into existence. So
let's
okay.
manifest it.
Let's manifest. So, okay, let's finally talk about Iceman Comet. We have to talk about Iceman Comet because, boy, howdy, is this an endurance test in all the best ways. It is the only American film to be released with two intermissions. That's fun. It came out on October 29th, 1973. It's obviously, for anyone, you know, it doesn't know, it's based on the Eugene O'Neill play, in case you don't know the basic bare bones of the plot, I'll relate it very quickly. It's set in 1912. A saloon and rooming house owned by Harry Hope, who was Frederick March, is filled with 12 dead-end alcoholics, including Hope himself, who while away the hours drinking themselves into oblivion. One of their former drinking buddies, a man named Hickey, returns a changed man since they saw him last. He professes to have learned his ways about the evils of drink, but more than that, the evils of ever even having pipe dreams, namely the delusions that all these guys live under, that these men will ever actually do anything with their lives. Hickey tries to preach to them that they should give up these dreams and just accept who they are. That, Hickey insists, will lead them all to a much happier existence. So, yeah, fun story. Hickey is played by Lee Marvin. As I mentioned, Frederick March plays Harry Hope. Robert Ryan is in it. A very young Jeff Bridges is in it. Bradford Dillman, Boss Hogg himself, Sorrel Book, is in this movie. Moses Gunn, Clifton James, George Voskovec from 12 Angry Men, and Hildy Brooks is one of the prostitutes, Margie. Now, it's directed by John Frankenheimer, which we said. And this movie, I never knew the origin of this, of like, why 4 hours? Like, what the hell? And it was only until just a little while ago when Larry Karaszewski did a Trailers from Hell on it, where he talked about this film was produced by a company called the American Film Theater, which was the brainchild of a guy named Eli Landau, who had a mad dream, which was via a subscription service. This, again, think about this. This is the early 70s. Via a subscription service, he would book movie adaptations of award-winning plays with big stars and low budgets, and he would book them in like Monday nights and Tuesday nights of theaters when they didn't have a lot of business. And so they did films like A Delicate Ballast with Katharine Hepburn, Rhinoceros with Gene Wilder, and Zero Mostel, their only other film they did together, other than the producers, The Three Sisters, The Man in the Glass Booth with Maximilian Schell. And they are all sort of full-out cinematic adaptations of the plays, except in like the case of The Iceman Cometh, which was the first one, it really is in a lot of ways just the play. It's a filmed version of the play, and even the film version even leaves some stuff out, but it's 4 hours long. It is the closest you're going to get to see it if you never go see it live.
That's
This is the
right.
version. It's amazing it even exists at all.
It's madness is what it is. Like, it is absolute madness. Yeah, the first time I saw this, I was like, what the hell? It really is a, not, I think a lot of us have seen a filmed stage production. So where, like, I know, like, during lockdown in 2020, and Brian Dennehy passed, and, he was well versed in Eugene O'Neill and Arthur Miller, and he had worked extensive. I mean, everybody's like, Tommy Boy actor dies. I'm like, okay, y'all need to can that, because Brian Dennehy was like, I mean, I love him in Tommy Boy, don't get me wrong,
Right, but
but I
yeah,
mean,
he did some
dude
other
is like,
things at Tommy Boy.
he's like a legitimate actor. And so he was a fixture in mainly in like the Chicago theater scene. And so when he died, the Goodman Theater in Chicago made available the stage performance of him as Willie Loman in Death of a Salesman. And so that was a filmed for, like, they filmed the stage version,
Right, they put a
live
camera
performance.
while it was being
Right.
performed. Yeah.
And so I think a lot of us, have seen that, or seen, like, I remember when I was in high school and we watched like some weird, taped version of like Agamemnon or something. Like, that was
They did
weird.
it for Hamilton just a couple of years ago, which was a
Right,
filmed
right.
version of the play.
And
Yeah.
so it's like, or like Spike Lee did, the David Byrne American Utopia, again, filming a stage production, and some of them work. Spike Lee's American Utopia, that worked beautifully. And other times it's like, what, this is not translating. It doesn't, you don't get the, it's like, oh, you're watching the play, but you're you're at home, not in the theater, which is a whole different experience.
Yeah.
But this, though, it is very much a play, but it's not quite filmed like a movie, and it's
Yeah.
not quite filmed like a television episode. It's like we're sitting on stage with them. We're not in the audience. We're there with them
Right, there were
on
close-ups,
stage
there were
during,
camera
yeah.
movements, yeah.
It's weird. It's like you're in one of these, like, weird performances where the people sit on the stage. I mean, that's what it was. And so it's so fascinating to me that, first of all, it got made, and that Frankenheimer got convinced to do it. I think I looked this up, and Frankenheimer, which I love reading any interview with John Frankenheimer, because every movie he worked on was the greatest movie, like the greatest experience he ever had. I love that man. It is like hyperbole is his middle name. But
Except for Island of Dr.
he
Moreau. I think he probably didn't say it about that one,
he
but
probably didn't say that.
all the other
No.
ones, yes.
All the other ones. But he is talking. So he was in Paris with his wife Evans, who's the prostitute Cora in the film. And he gets contacted by a producer who says that Eli Landau wants him to direct The Iceman Cometh for American Film Theater. And he said, no, I'm not going to be interested. He and Evans wanted to stay in Paris. And then this is what's so great. Then Frankenheimer remembers that he had seen an adaptation of James Joyce's Ulysses and thought it was awful. And so he said, yeah, Joe Strick did Ulysses, and I thought it didn't work at all. So my ego kind of got in there, and I said, if I don't do this, someone else will, and they're liable to screw it up. You better do this. So, and he couldn't remember the play, and he couldn't find a copy of it in English in Paris, but he found a version in French, and he read it in French, and he says, he calls Eddie back, Eddie Lewis back, and he says, yeah, okay, I'm gonna do it, but I want one of three people playing Hickey: Marlon Brando, Gene Hackman, or Lee Marvin. And he said, he made one provision. He says, I do not want Jason Robards, which Jason Robards played the role, right? And Frankenheimer says, well, yeah, I've worked with Jason. He's a great actor. He's a friend of mine. But he had done it so often on stage, and the idea of him directing him on that was just unexciting to Frankenheimer. So he was like, no, I don't want to direct him in this. So I will do it if it's one of these three actors, and Jason Robards absolutely cannot be involved. It's just, I love it. And I love it that he's like, I don't want to see one of these screwed up, so I might as well do it.
Amazing to think
So.
why things get made sometimes, right? You
I
know, you're
know,
like,
I
really? You're
know.
going to devote yourself? And Lee
Yeah.
Marvin famously said that because he did the reason that Eli Landau was able to get these made was because, as I
Yeah.
mentioned, the salaries were virtually nothing, and they paid
That's
Lee
right.
Marvin 25 grand to be in this movie, which is, again, first of all, Lee Marvin famously said, Eli Landau cost me $250,000 because that was his quote at the time, and he did it for
Yeah,
25
yeah,
grand.
yeah.
But I mean, not only is he only getting 25 grand to star in a movie, he's getting 25 grand to star in a 4-hour movie, which is, I mean, now I'm of course Lee Marvin isn't in every scene, but a lot of
No,
the
but
other
the
actors are, you know,
that's right, but
Marcher's in through
every
most of it. Yeah.
that's right. In every scene, he's got paragraphs and paragraphs and paragraphs of dialogue. I mean, that last whole thing, I mean, it's like, holy crap, man, that's a lot of memorization. Which, by the way, Marlon Brando was like, oh yeah, I can't remember those lines. Sorry, I can't do that.
I mean, it's again, I think it's sort of fitting. By the way, I mentioned that Robert Ryan is in this film. This is also his final film.
Yeah.
March would live on until 1975, but he had learned that he had had, I think it was prostate
He has
cancer,
prostate
and so
cancer.
he had formally retired. Ryan didn't even, I think, barely lived to even see this film get released. I think he died
Yeah, I don't
right
think,
around the
yeah, I
same
think
time.
it was this one, and there was another, I think this was the last one he made, but there was another film,
Is it Executive Action, I think?
Executive Action, that's right. And both
Yeah.
of them came out after he died. I think it
Right.
was lung cancer that took him out.
Yeah.
Maybe.
It's
I might be
amazing
wrong about
though when
that.
you think that the last 10 minutes of the movie is basically just Ryan and March. They have two,
Yeah.
March has a big speech and then Ryan has a big speech and then it closes out. And it's, March is in it. He looks old. He's supposed to look old because these are guys that are drinking themselves to death. They all look 20 years older than they should because
That's
of
right.
what they're doing to themselves. But, March, it's what I mentioned earlier. He has that stability to him, even in a role like
Yeah.
this, where he is a lush. And, his best scene is the scene where he talks about, you know what, I'm going to go out and I'm going to walk around the neighborhood. I'm going to find, because
Right.
they talk about that he's literally never left this building in
For
20
20
years because
years.
he owns
Yeah.
it and he just lives there. And he's quite literally never gone outside in 20 years. And he finally says, I'm going to go out and do it. And he does it. And then he comes back and he kind of shuffles in and he says, well, oh my God, I'm gonna be hit by a car. And you know that he's making all this up because he's terrified of being
Right.
outside. And it's for a guy who was as old as he was, and for a movie that, again, that is 4 hours long and incredibly wordy, March is still in there swinging. I mean, he's as good in this movie as he is in any
Yeah.
other movies. And it's just amazing to think that he still had his powers at that age.
That's right. So he was well versed in O'Neill. He and Florence Eldridge were in the original production of O'Neill's Long Day's Journey Into Night.
Right.
And so this was up, right up his alley. But he had not done, I think his last stage play was Gideon in the
Right. Yes,
mid-60s.
yes, yes.
And he had retired
I love he kept
after,
saying, I'm retiring, and then
I
they would get
know,
him to do another
that's
movie.
right. He, I think it was after Tick, 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 if I'm not mistaken. And he was diagnosed with prostate cancer, 1970, I think. And Frankenheimer, when he, takes on this, he takes on this project, and he's like, I know who I want for Harry Hope. I want Freddie. And they had been very good friends since working on 7 Days in May. And he calls Freddie up and he begs him to come do it. And he's very, very sick. And the production would not insure him. So Frankenheimer put up his own money to insure March for this. And so I think that is incredible and always kind of makes me a little teary-eyed thinking of
Yeah,
it.
that's
And
wonderful.
so they did extensive rehearsals for this because, again, I mean, it's a play, right? So the and the it was all shot in order. And
Making it extra hard for themselves.
exactly. Exactly. And so March, being so sick, he did not come to rehearsals. And so they had an actor who was a stand-in who read all of Harry Hope's lines. And then when it came time to film, Frankenheimer, he was a little worried, like, I don't know, he's pretty ill. I don't know about this. But the minute the camera was rolling, he said that it was like a bolt of lightning. And well, actually, I get that wrong. He missed rehearsal, but he came to the rehearsal hall for the last day and they did a full run through. And he was like on. Like, he comes in, he's really, really sick. And then the minute they start, it was like a switch was flipped. And that was, the whole production is that, there were times where he had a really hard time putting in a full day. So, he would have to be, resting or whatever. But when it came time for his part, he, every ounce of whatever little energy he had, he was putting into that role. So, I mean, ever the consummate professional all the way to the end. And you're right. I mean, it was another 2 years before he died. In the last 2 years, he was in really rough shape. But he's such, the character is so, I mean, everybody in that saloon is just is the most depressing movie ever. And every single one of them is just lost. They're all lost souls. And Harry Hope is so frail and so terrified. And I think terrified of like his own grief about his wife and like he stopped living when she died. But you're right, like March has this commanding presence, even when you look at him and you see that physically he's frail and he's old. It's incredible what he's able to convey. It's one of the finest, I think, between March and Ryan, those are two of the finest performances ever. Yeah, I am comfortable with saying that. Just at like this is like actors, these are like real actors, actors. Like I think you've really like you cannot show this to like somebody goes, oh, I want to learn about Frederick March, and you go, you know what? I'm gonna have you watch The Iceman Cometh tonight. That's where I mean this
You
is
clear your
really
schedule.
yeah, this is really for insane people like us and people who are, either they're really into literature, they're actors themselves, or they're, well versed in playwrights. I think you've really got it ha it's definitely a very small group of people, right? But when you're looking at these performances, it is like a master class in acting. It is such a gift that we have this to watch because it is the closest thing we'll have to seeing that, that play without actually like going to the theater, which I mean it's, there's been revivals and
Sure,
like
right.
Jason Robards played and like Denzel Washington that did a revival, Nathan Lane did one, but this is kind of a it's we're seeing this, generation of actors at the nearing the end, doing what they did best. And next to Frederick March, I mean, you would think who can hold up to him, but man, Robert Ryan is really terrific. Just, I mean, I think to me, the least dynamic performance in it is Lee Marvin. And I think that's saying something. Because Lee Marvin is magnificent, but for me, it's all about Ryan and March in this.
I mean, talk about not leaving anything, leaving it all on the table, right? It's like your final film is a 4-hour adaptation of, and then, on top of you're like, wow, that's an endurance test. And then on top of it, it's the Iceman Cometh. I mean, it's
That's right.
this thing where it's just guys talking for 4 hours straight. By the way, just as a side note, I always get just, sometimes I just forget about, like, it feels like eras of passing. You're like, Jeff Bridges is in this movie. Like, Jeff
Yeah.
Bridges is in movies today. And you're like,
That's
there's
right.
a guy who's working who worked with Frederick March,
Yeah.
which feels
Yeah.
like that's a character from eons ago. And yet you're like,
That's
no,
right.
there's a guy who you could presumably interview today and say, what was it like working with
Hey,
Frederick March?
I'm trying to work on that.
Oh, nice.
And that, I'm hopeful.
Okay.
But that's, and he's such a adorable baby face in it too. Oh my
Oh, yeah.
goodness.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, how intense, I mean, look, he grew up in, his dad was not of the same stature, in terms of serious acting. I mean,
Right.
he was more of like, he's like a B actor or whatever,
He was
but he
like a
grew
star,
up
less than an actor kind of
right.
thing.
And he, so he grew up around that, but you do have to wonder, like, was he not just crap in his pants, like sitting there acting opposite these, like intimidating guys? I mean, Robert Ryan is intimidating, right? By all accounts, the nicest man, and like he was very progressive, and he always picked, like, he always played bastards in all of, the movies and stuff, because I think it was he wanted to do something different from what he was in real life. But can you imagine being, I mean, I don't know, Jeff Bridges, what, 23, maybe 23 years old in this,
Yeah.
and sitting across from these
Frederick March
guys
and
that,
Robert Ryan.
yeah, I mean,
Oh
these are
my
like
God.
absolute, these guys are nuts. And then, is it Moses,
Moses Gunn.
Moses Gunn? Oh my God, he's terrific. Absolutely terrific in this. It's just, we are very, very lucky that this survived, and that, you can get a copy of it. And it's not, look, it's not great. I don't think the original negatives are probably in great shape. So the Kino Blu-ray that's out there, there's a lot of, like, fading, and,
Yeah.
different, the quality in the film changes a lot. But, it was a low budget production, so who knows what the original elements are like.
Right. Well, there was a
But
3-hour version, and then there's the full 4-hour version, and you can see the color changes where the edits were made to cut it down to 3 hours. Now, I will say, everybody, if you're going to get this movie and watch it, watch the 4-hour version, you
I
coward.
mean,
Watch
look,
the
if they're
whole
gonna
thing.
be,
Come on, what are you doing?
well, and I think, if I'm not mistaken, they cut out, like, I think they cut out like an hour and something, and then they ended up putting most of it back. And then there's one character from the play that they just left out all,
Yeah,
completely.
admitted entirely, yeah.
But, sometimes I think, I think this is probably about as faithful of an adaptation as you're going to get.
Oh, yeah. We're...
I mean, it's pretty straight adaptation. And, I think sometimes, maybe some things are not going to work quite right, or, they only had so much budget. So, you make some creative decisions there. But this is damn near as close as you're going to get. And that's the one thing that I, wish that we had. I wish that we had, film of some of these stage performances. I would love to see Edward G. Robinson and Jenna Rollins in the original Middle of the Night on Broadway. I mean,
Yeah.
that would be incredible. I would love to see Long Day's Journey into Night, or see Tallulah Bankhead on stage in The Skin of Our Teeth. So there's kind of this part of me that's so sad that we don't have a record of those performances. So to have this is really a gift.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and yeah, again, you got to be really dedicated to transform yourself.
I
And
watched it over a
it's,
couple of nights. I was not able to do it
yeah.
in one go. I'm like,
Well, and
why
it's
am I
just
going to
so
punish myself?
bleak. It's
Yes.
so bleak. It's not like it's a, a musical or something. I
No.
mean, this is like, this is where men go to die.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
And
Yeah.
it's just like, I'm like, oh my, and every once in a while, my husband, and I revisited this, and it's been forever since I've watched it. And I was kind of, in preparation for this, I was kind of steeling myself for it. Like, oh my God, I don't know if I can do this. And, my husband would walk in on some like long speech, and then he would like do the Homer Simpson, like slowly backing out into the hedge, like, all right, I'm out of here, some spiel about, get out of here, you whores, or whatever. And he's like, all right, I'm leaving, so time for me to make my exit.
So you choose to spend your evening, Jill. That's fine. Okay.
That's
But I'm not,
right.
yeah. So, but yeah, it's an amazing artifact, and it's great seeing Frederick March so still in command of his powers at that late an age. And as you say, we knew he was ill. And even though the movie itself isn't quote unquote fun, it's an amazing document. And we are, as you said, we're so lucky it exists. And I can't say I enjoyed it watching it a second time, but I admired it because it's, how can you not? It's Frederick March and Robert Ryan and Lee Marvin and Bradford Dillman just really burning it.
Bradford Dillman is fantastic, which Dillman was also in the original Long Day's Journey into
That's
Sunrise.
right.
So
That's
he and
right.
March
That's
had
right.
worked together. And so it's not an enjoyable film, but it
We're
is,
really selling it here.
I don't know, but it is, it's, you know, it's a fascinating story though, and it is so superbly acted, but it does make me really sad because it is the final performance of two incredible actors. And so it is hard to watch them in this where that's it. It's like when you watch like a Gene Harlow movie, and Gene Harlow died young and it tragically, right? But we never saw her age. So when we watch her in her movies, or like, Marilyn Monroe, right? We never saw her age. And so they're preserved in film at the age, right? But anytime I watch, later films of like my favorite actors and like last performances, man, I get so sad. I'm like, oh my God, this is it, and I'm glad we have it. I'm glad that they didn't die young. I'm glad that they kept making movies, but it's definitely makes you think about your own mortality, and you think about like what were they thinking when they made this. And so it's definitely you have to be in a mood for it, I would say
Most
say
certainly.
that.
And March had to know this was it. He had to
He knew
know, you
he was
know?
dying. I mean, he was dying, and he had health problems, and again, don't smoke, kids, it's bad for you. And so, had he had that now, they probably, treatment now, I mean, like prostate cancer is like one of the most treatable cancers you can get, and so not, but I mean, I think his last like year or two, he was like, catheterized the whole
Yeah,
time,
very ill. Yeah,
like
very ill. Yeah.
super ill and like bedbound, and not, it was not, that was not something you wanted to get then. And so I think he knew that his time was limited. And I think Robert Ryan, I think he knew he was terminal too, but I don't think he knew, but lung cancer can like switch overnight, but he knew that that was it for him too. And his wife had just died, so I think he actually wasn't gonna do the film. And then his wife died, and he was like, screw it, I've got nothing else to do, so that almost didn't happen.
Jeez. Do you happen to know if Frederick March's daughter is still around? Because they had two
Okay,
children, and one of them
the
died.
two, yes,
The son died in a car accident. They were, but
yes.
is his daughter still around?
Okay, so as far as I know, yes. I have been in touch with her, one of her kids.
Oh, wow. Okay.
They live in Italy. Her name's Penny,
Right.
and Penelope, and she married an Italian guy, and they had three, maybe four kids. And she's an expat. She's been living in Florence all these years,
Wow.
and So as of when I made contact, this was probably 2018, 2019, she was still alive and doing well.
Good.
I am not quite sure if that's still the case. She would be in her late 80s now, I think.
Because they adopted them in their in the 40s, the him and Florence, so
Yeah, I think she was a actually, she might have been early 30s,
early 30s, so yeah, there
1930s.
you go.
Yeah, and I think Anthony was a little bit after. I think Anthony might have one or two kids, but that's a side that I've not been able to reach out to. But yeah, the Fantacci, March Fantacci clan, is very much alive, and yeah, so and the recent controversy that happened at University of Wisconsin, they are not very happy about, which I think is also why they were a little hesitant to speak to me. Yeah,
Which you helped
so
step in to correct. By the way.
yes, I did. And when I was still writing scripts for TCM, I wrote, they had a Star of the Month. Actually, it was Millie who programmed that. This was 2019, and so I wrote all of the scripts for his Star of the Month, and I really, really, really wanted to work that in, and I was not allowed to. And this was really before it had made like national news. It was still very much a kind of a regional news story that I was aware of. And I kind of wanted to clear the air, like, this is not the case. And this is a, well-intentioned thing that is misguided. And then, TCM finally acknowledged it, and Ben Mankiewicz did a big thing about it, and I think that was last year that finally came out. And so I think some of it's getting corrected, but I mean, his name's still been pulled off that theater. So I told Millie when she interviewed me, I was like, look, for all the things, if you want to pull his name off the theater, pull it off for the fact that he like pinched asses. Like he was a bit of a cad on that front, but he was not a Klansman.
No, he's one of the
So
most outspoken liberals in Hollywood, you know, and yet
no, he
that's the
was
thing he got
not.
dinged for because it's people didn't understand what
No,
they were
I
doing, so.
mean, he was like outspoken for Black rights before it was cool to do it. So, like, I was like, okay, this is someone did not do their homework. So, but at least that is getting a little bit of traction. So I feel pretty good about that.
You should. It's wonderful. You did a great thing for that for March's legend. So, you mentioned in the interview that you are working on a book, and so
Oh,
that's a
yeah.
perfect way to end would end the show here because again, we could talk about Frederick March
Oh,
another
I
hour and a
know.
half if we wanted to. But so the exit question for you is: if you could meet Mr. March today, what would
Yeah.
you ask him about? I know that's hard to limit it down to one thing, but what you know, I mean, what's something that occurred to you that you would wanted, and you know, you can go come at this from any angle. It could be a personal, a movie. How, what would you just want to sit and like have lunch with them and chat with them about?
I've thought about this, and yeah, I mean, I could talk his ear off. I think the thing that I would want to know is who would he want to work with today?
Oh man, can you
Like
imagine?
what filmmaker, what actor, who is he, interested in? Who does he find, what filmmaker does he find fascinating? What is this generation's William Wyler or Frankenheimer or Bill Wellman, that's what I want to know, is who would he work with? And then I'm sitting here thinking, who would he work with? Like, would he be working with I don't know. He worked with Dorothy Arzner a lot. I think he worked. He would. I think he made, more movies with her. I think he was the one actor that worked with her more than anyone else. So maybe would he work with Ava DuVernay, or would he work with Jane Campion? Yeah, I'm interested in that. Like, or would he be in, Angelina Jolie's directorial debut? Like, I'm curious about that. Like, who would he, what up and coming female director would he work for?
Interesting.
And, who would he find, in terms of stage actors, making the crossover to film? Like, who would he be with? I'd like to see him do something with Jon Hamm. I don't know. Something tells me he and Jon Hamm would be great in a movie together.
That would be amazing to see.
And maybe because Jon Hamm kind of has that like 1950s quality about him, and so I'm thinking like Man in the Gray Flannel Suit, Mac, I could maybe see that. So I think that's what I would want to know. I'd want to know, like, who's checking the boxes for you right now, and why do you think that they're, up and coming, or why would they be deserving of your talents? So that I think that's what I'd really like to know.
All right. The mind reels the idea of like Frederick March with like a stack of Blu-rays just going through movies
I
that he
mean, I
has to
know.
catch up on.
I
Well,
know.
what's this Kenneth Loniger guy? What's he about? Oh, let me Manchester by the Sea. I'll watch this, you know,
Oh my God. I
like
mean, could you see him
that
like in, I'm trying to think, like, I, or like, he made a lot of biopics. So like, would he be in one of Larry Karaszewski's movies?
kind
Like,
of thing.
I just, I think, or like, could he be like in a Spike Lee joint?
Oh
Like,
my God, the mind
just could
reel
you
with that
even,
idea, yeah.
I know, like, it's bonkers. Or would he like go, play it safe and go Spielberg? But I mean, he never played it safe in his career, ever. So that's what really fascinates me about that, is like, who would he go for? And I don't know. I think
The
there's a lot of
mind
choices.
reels.
The mind does reel.
Mind reel.
So
So, well, like I said, you know, I've mentioned on other episodes of the show that like I use this show as a way for me to learn about people that I don't know much about because it forces me, you know, I let the guest pick the subject. And then I learned like last month we talked Russ Meyer. I hadn't seen hardly any Russ Meyer movies. So I was seeing all these Russ Meyer movies. This one was not that. This was really to just luxuriate in how much I love Frederick March. But I still learned a lot because I said I read the biography of him and I saw a bunch of films of his I had never seen, including, as we mentioned, Middle of the Night, which is just absolutely terrific. So the stuff is out there, everybody. It's a little hard to find some of it. You have to work a little hard, but it's out there. And he is, you will never be bored by a performance by Frederick
No.
March, ever. Even if the movie is
Hey,
a so-so, he
that's
will be
right.
great in it, you
That's
know?
right. And you
So.
know what? I think after this most recent rewatch of The Iceman Cometh, I have my like idea for my first tattoo, is I'm just gonna get bejeez tattooed on me. 'Cause he says bejeez a lot in that film.
All
Bejeez.
right. But by the time you write the book, you'll have to have it done by then. It's like your author
I just
photo
got to
will be
figure out
the
where I put it. Do I get
tattoo.
like the old tramp stamp?
Yeah.
Bejeez.
Frederick March tramp stamp. Those are two
Hey,
words never put
if there
together
was,
before in
and
history.
you know what? If I will combine anything with Frederick March to blow people's
Absolutely.
minds.
There you
I've
go.
yeah, you know, I'm known for pushing the envelope on that. So yeah, Frederick March tramp stamp. There
So,
we go.
well, Jill, thank you
Oh
once again for
goodness.
coming back. I
Of
really enjoyed
course.
talking to you, and this was just, again, such a pure pleasure to just geek out over this guy
I
because
know.
it's just
Thank you
so
for
good. There's
having
so much
me.
good. Oh, of course. Why don't you tell people where they can find you out on the internet?
So, look, I'm no longer on Twitter because of reasons, but I am,
We all know what those are.
we know what those are. I am on Blue Sky intermittently. It's like biscuit kitten dot whatever social dot blue sky. But the big thing now is I have launched a business called Cine Journeys, and Cine, like CineJourneys.com. And we also have a Substack. And my partner Aaron West and I, we actually are about to like fully launch our website. And it's the like 10 second is like we have journeys into specific genres or filmmakers or an actor. And it's kind of like a deep dive into that. And we have accompanying podcast. And we're basically creating what doesn't what we want to exist, which is a platform and a community of film lovers to discuss film without the the reason why I'm no longer on Twitter, without the trappings that often come with online communities where it's toxic and all that. So we are we kind of soft launched it in the fall, kind of like a beta. But yeah, the site is almost ready to be unveiled, and we think it's pretty awesome. So cinejourneys.com and Instagram and Blue Sky Biscuit Kitten is where you can find me.
Very exciting. Looking forward to checking all that out. And again, thank you once
Yay.
again. This is just fantastic. It's
Yeah.
such an honor to have you on. So I really,
Oh my
really do
God.
appreciate it. So
Well, it's an honor for me to be here and like to be able to talk about
Frederick Marsh, no normal
my
person wants to
weird,
talk about Frederick Marsh. So
no normal
happy to do it.
person. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you so much, Rob.
Yeah. Thank you all for listening. Of course, you can find all the back episodes on our website, findwaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to Fade Out on any podcatcher of your choice. We are still on X slash Twitter. I don't know how long that will last, but I'm still managing to make my way through it at Fade Out Pod. We also are on Blue Sky. And if you want to support Find Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FW Podcasts. So big thanks to Monique D and Donald McWaters for their support of Fade Out. Really appreciate it. So thank you for listening. We'll be back with another episode next month, but we've reached the end of this particular script. So for now, it's time to fade out.
And then when this nation rejected you, lost its faith in you, and began militantly to oppose you, you violated that oath by simply not resigning from office and turning this country over to someone who could represent the people of the United States.
And that would be General James Mattoon Scott, wouldn't it? I don't know whether to laugh at that kind of megalomania or simply cry.
James Mattoon Scott, as you put it, hasn't the slightest interest in his own glorification. But he does have an abiding concern about the survival of this country.
Then, by God, run for office! You have such a fervid, passionate, evangelical affection for your country. Why in the name of God don't you have any faith in the system of government you're so hell-bent to protect? You say I've duped the people, General. I built them. I've misled them. I've stripped them naked and made them defenseless. You accuse me of having lost their faith, deliberately and criminally shut my ears to the national voice.
I do.
Well, where the hell have you heard that voice, General? In freight elevators? In dark alleys? In secret places in the dead of night? How did that voice seep into a locked room full of conspirators? That's not where you hear the voice of the people, General, not in this republic. You want to defend the United States of America, then defend it with the tools it supplies you with, its Constitution. You ask for a mandate, General, from a ballot box. You don't steal it after midnight, when the country has its back turned.